True Crime Brewery contains disturbing content related to real-life crimes. Medical information is opinion based on facts of a crime and should not be interpreted as medical advice or treatment. Listener discretion is advised.
Welcome to True Crime Brewery. I'm Jill.
And I'm Dick.
Jana Eastburn was the sole survivor, just 22 months old, when her mother, Catherine Eastburn, and her siblings, 5-year-old Kara and 3-year-old Aaron, were stabbed to death on May 9, 1985, in their Fayetteville, North Carolina home. Jana had been abandoned in her crib for 3 days before police responded to the concerns of neighbors and they entered the home. She was dehydrated and crying hysterically, with her arms outstretched. Alone within the carnage of the brutal triple murders of her mother and sisters. Jana's father, Air Force Captain Gary Eastburn, was away doing training in Alabama when his wife and daughters were killed. Catherine had placed an ad to rehome their dog because the family was planning to relocate to England. The man who came to the house took the dog, Sergeant Tim Hennis, and he became the primary suspect. This case, including eyewitness testimony, physical evidence, and 3 trials, captured the attention of people across the country and continues to garner speculation. Join us at the quiet end today for our discussion of this very complicated and fascinating case, the Eastburn family murders.
Here we have a nice North Carolina beer. I like the name. It's called Follow Your Heart Southward. And it's brewed by Casita Cerveceria in Fountain, North Carolina. This is a big old imperial stout, aged in bourbon barrels with some vanilla beans added. One of my favorites.
Okay.
In all its incarnations. This particular one is black with a nice tan head, leaves a little bit of lacing. The aroma and taste are just absolutely phenomenal. Chocolate, little vanilla, some coffee, some bourbon, all working really well together. Lovely beer.
Wow, you don't say that very often.
It's a nice, rich, creamy, excellent beer. Let's
Perfect.
Open it up.
Let's try it. I can't wait.
Okay, we'll join the denizens at the quiet end.
Sure. A couple of them are waiting over there, interested in this case. So
they
let's
are.
Get started, yeah?
Okay. So Catherine Furnish, her maiden name, was 20 years old and engaged to her college boyfriend, and she had to be talked into going to the singles club softball game in Westwood, Kansas, and that's where she met her future husband, Gary Eastburn. Gary was 25 years old, and he never passed up a chance to play softball. But he'd never been to a singles club either, and a friend had talked him into it. He was immediately attracted to Katie, who was wearing cut-off jeans, and she joined him for a post-game beer. Then she let him drive her home. A week later, they met at another softball game. Later that night, Gary leaned over to kiss Katie goodnight, and she stopped him and told him she was kind of engaged to a guy.
Yeah, nobody wants to hear that.
That's for sure. Is that a turnoff or what?
It depends. It might motivate you to try harder.
Well, and it did for Gary. As he was driving home, he decided not to give up on her. So he dropped by Katie's parents' house after work on Fridays, took her on drives through the countryside on Sundays. Now, her parents wondered at first what she saw in him, particularly since she was kind of engaged.
Yeah.
But Gary won them over.
Yeah, well, I think part of it was that he just had this job as a shoe salesman and hadn't gone to college.
Yeah, but he wasn't the type of person that the Furnishes wanted for their daughter.
No, he didn't seem like he was upwardly mobile.
Right.
Yeah. But he certainly did become that way.
Yeah, I mean, the Furnishes did have a nice family life.
I think they inspired him.
Yeah, and Gary wanted to be a part of that family. Katie's father, Gene, made a good living as a livestock broker, and her mother, Jane, was a stay-at-home mom. The family ate together and went to church. Katie was the oldest of 4 kids, and her best friend was her sister, Susie.
Katie's classmates and teachers remembered her as a shy, smart girl who got along with everyone, and she never got into trouble. She didn't drink or smoke, and her first date was going to the prom. And she just went with a boy who worked with her at the local dime store, so it wasn't a romantic thing, although he might have wanted it to be. She was very cute. Now, Katie graduated in 1971, and she went to Kansas State, which was 100 miles from her home. If it had been up to her, she'd have stayed home and taken college classes there, like most of her classmates were. But that's not what her family wanted. They wanted her to go away to college. They wanted Katie to be successful. So her family was very kind to Gary, and Gary felt very at home with them. His parents had actually split up when he was 12, and that forced his mom, who was a cashier, to work very long hours just to pay the bills. And Gary never did get along with his stepfather. So his childhood was fine up until then, but growing up in his home was really nothing like the Furnish home. To him, it was ideal.
And one day, Katie's fiancé, remember, she's still kind of engaged to this guy.
Yeah.
So he calls, and Gary's sitting with her on the living room couch in her house. Katie excused herself and came back a couple minutes later. She said to Gary, "He gave me an ultimatum. It was either you or him. So I hung up the phone." Guess we know the answer to that, huh?
Yes, and when Gary told this story, he was just thrilled, it seemed like.
Well, it's a pretty cool story.
Yeah. So they were married less than a year later, and Gary enrolled at the University of Missouri just a few weeks after that. Katie worked as a dietitian to help put him through school, and she got pregnant and had Kara, their first daughter, on May 21st, 1979, just 1 week after Gary graduated from college. Gary had decided to join the military after he learned that there was more money in air traffic controlling than in pharmaceutical sales, which was the path that his major at Missouri was taking him in. But the military moved them around often, as they do. After Kara was born, Gary was stationed in Goldsboro, North Carolina, then Wichita Falls. Aaron was born in Texas. Katie cried when Gary was transferred back to Eastern North Carolina. But actually, Fort Bragg wasn't as bad as they'd heard. They kind of grew to like it there. And Gary became chief of air traffic control at Pope Air Force Base. Jana, the baby, was born on July 15, 1983. And in December 1984, that's when they rented the house at 367 Summer Hill. And this was an upper-middle-class subdivision that was nearby the base.
Right, it wasn't on the base.
No.
So, to me, that automatically makes it a little more desirable.
Yeah, base housing isn't the greatest. Right. I've never been to it.
Yeah.
But it is a rental, which is important in this case because there might be stuff from other people around there that used to live there. Hairs, fingerprints. You don't think so?
Well, I'm a little unsure how to take that.
Why?
I mean, yeah, there is.
I just think there's more turnover of people living there.
But they could have bought a house, and unless it was a new house that nobody had ever lived in, you're always going to find evidence of previous residents of the house.
Well, sure, but I think when you buy a house, you tend to stay there longer than when you rent, so there's more turnover.
Yeah, I still don't quite know what you're trying to get at.
I'm saying there could be more fingerprints and hair because it was a rental and there were more people there. But they were starting to make some money, and Gary wanted to fulfill Katie's lifelong dream of buying a farm and raising a horse with their kids. Going to the 3-month class in Alabama would help them make that dream a reality. Now, neither Katie nor Gary liked being separated, but they had plans, and they knew this was just a temporary situation.
Yeah, and he had actually thought about taking the family with him, but that would have meant subletting or trying to sublet their house in North Carolina, renting a place in Alabama, and they would have had to pull the oldest kid out of school and enroll her in school in Alabama. So I guess they decided eventually that the 3-month period would be tolerable to be separated and that Katie and the family would stay in North Carolina.
Right, and that's kind of a sacrifice you make when you're in the service.
It sure is. Sunday, May 12th, 1985, Mother's Day, as it turned out, The Eastburns' next-door neighbor, Army Sergeant Bob Seafelt, arrived home after bailing out one of his soldiers who had had a little too much to drink the previous night. When he returned home, he was greeted by his concerned wife, who had noticed the newspapers piled up on the Eastburns' porch. The family car was still in the driveway, and the baby stroller was parked in its usual place by the back door. And then the more Bob thought about it, he realized he hadn't seen the Eastburns in at least 3 days. He decided to check on Katie and her kids, as he was aware that Gary was away at training out of state. When he reached the front door, he could hear the cries of the baby, Jana, but his knocks and doorbell rings went unanswered.
So he went back home and he called the Eastburns' babysitter, Julie Searsniak, who rushed right over. Bob was waiting outside the Eastburn home when she arrived, and Julie peeked into a window and saw the baby, standing alone in her crib, filthy, upset, with her arms stretched out for somebody to pick her up. So Julie began to look for a way to get into the house, but Bob convinced her that she should wait for the police to get there.
That's probably a good move.
Yeah, but I could see your instinct would be to get that baby.
Sure.
Yeah.
But at least someone's thinking, well, you know, something bad might have happened and it could be a crime scene. So let's let the cops arrive.
Sure.
So Officer William Toman was the first police officer to arrive. He checked the doors and windows. He found no sign of forced entry. He did find a note jammed inside the storm door. Mrs. Eastburn, get in touch with your husband by phone. Signed, Deputy Price. Toman rang the doorbell. No baby cried, and Seafelt was wondering if he had overreacted. And we're starting to get some neighbors gathering in the street out front, because there's some excitement going on at one of these houses.
Yeah, the police are there.
Police are there, and then Toman's sergeant drove up, and he was talking to Toman on the front porch. So what do you think we should do, the sergeant asked. Toman wasn't sure, but then he heard the baby crying. He leaned over the porch railing, pressed his face to the bedroom window, and cupped his hands to help him see inside.
So little Jana Eastburn was standing in her crib, and Toman said, I've got no choice, I've got to go in. So he stepped over the railing, cut open a screen, and opened a window. And then he was hit with the horrible smell of death. Now, we've talked about that before. If you've experienced it, you know how horrible it is. And you know that there's no confusing it with anything else.
For sure.
So Jana's pajamas with little blue and yellow flowers just stank. And she was very pale. Her eyes were puffy from crying. A pile of stuffed animals and toys had been put in her crib as if someone wanted her to be entertained. They knew she was going to be alone. Jana wrapped both her arms around Toman's neck immediately, digging her fingers into his skin. And he passed her out the window to Bob Seafelt, along with some Pampers that he found next to the crib. Now he was prepared to find at least one dead body in this house. So he drew his gun, opened the door, and headed toward the master bedroom.
Now the body of 3-year-old Erin Eastburn was lying beside her parents' bed, wearing a white nightgown with lavender bows, and a pillow was leaning against her face. The nightstand beside the bed was knocked over onto its side. A knife had nearly severed Aaron's head. Toman walked around the bed and he looked over and saw Katie Eastburn, who was nude, stabbed, and dead, with a pillow covering her face.
Yeah, when he lifted the pillow, he saw that Katie's throat had also been slashed. She also had several stab wounds. So Toman backed out of the room and went back into Jana's bedroom, leaned out the window. He had a handkerchief over his face. The smell was so bad. And he told them to call an ambulance. But by this time, that smell of death had expanded to outside the window. So Bob Seafelt had a pretty good idea that something horrible had happened.
We know what's going on. And Seafelt also recognized that Jana's pajamas were the ones she'd been wearing when he saw the kids or the family Thursday night, 3 days before. So he realized that Katie was probably dead, because that's the only thing that would keep her from caring for her baby.
Yeah, or kidnapped. But he has the smell there, so that gives him an indication that she was probably killed. Toman, meanwhile, continued to walk through the house. He walked through the living room, where he saw Katie's sneakers still tied in the middle of the floor. Her blouse was crumpled up on the floor, and a basket of folded clothes had spilled onto the floor. So there had been a struggle. But it didn't seem like there was a big struggle because the furniture was all still in place, and there were even some of the kids' toys on the floor that looked like they hadn't been disturbed. William Huggins, the chief paramedic on duty, pulled up in an ambulance in the Eastburn driveway. Toman met him by the side door and told him he would have to go in to confirm the deaths. So Huggins followed Toman inside the house to the back bedroom, where he saw the body of Erin Eastburn. It was his job to officially pronounce her dead. Erin had been pulled off of her parents' bed, apparently, and onto her back, and her knees were left up in the air, so she appeared to be in some kind of sick sexual position. Now, this is a three-year-old, right? So that's right. Very sick. Now, she'd clearly been there for a long time, and he lifted her cold arm and checked for a pulse. Then he had to really kind of search to find a place between her chest wounds for his stethoscope to listen for a heartbeat. Of course, he didn't hear anything, and he had to repeat this same thing with Katie, pronouncing them both dead. So he got out of the house pretty much gagging. But Bob Seatfelt said, "There's three children and the mother, but I've only seen two." So Toman ran back inside the house and returned just seconds later, saying that he'd found another one. So Huggins had to go back inside, and this time he had to go to the bedroom across from Janice. This was where Kara Eastburn was found. He had to walk around a plastic buggy full of toys and a toy piano to her bed, which was against the far wall. Under a Star Wars bedspread, Kara was dead, and she also had her throat cut. The crime scene technicians arrived, and they got on their hands and knees and picked over the entire house. They worked for 4 hours working around the bodies. The photographer took pictures of the girls from several angles, then of Katie. They had to move their bodies and look underneath them. Now, disturbing 5-year-old Kara, they said, was just horrible. The killer had placed some white quilt batting on her chest, and Kara had been stabbed to the point where her organs were breaking through her skin. But when they moved Erin, it was just horrific, because when they lifted her, her head slumped over and nearly fell off. That's how badly her neck had been cut, nearly to the point of decapitation.
Pretty grisly scene.
It's very grisly, and I won't go into it any more than that. I think that gives you an idea of what a brutal murder scene this was.
But for three murders done with throat slashings and stabbings, the house had surprisingly little blood. There were some blood stains under the bodies, but there's almost no blood spattered onto the walls. The police continued their tour of the scene and found evidence in odd places. There's a tie back from a living room curtain found in Kara's room, and a piece of white rope was found in the middle of the street. The police put pieces of evidence into bags. They vacuumed the house and collected the bags. From the master bedroom, they took a sheet and bedspread with bloody ribbed impressions. At first glance, it looked as if somebody's corduroy pants had brushed against it.
The fingerprint examiner came and found prints on door frames that were almost 7 feet up from the floor. A palm print next to a bloody smear was found just above the living room doorway. The State Bureau of Investigation sent its lab experts to the house, and they used luminol on it that evening. The luminol showed them why the house hadn't been covered in blood spatter. The killer had actually taken some time to do some cleanup. Now, luminol reactions suggested that the killer had wiped down a bathroom sink, doorknobs, light switches, and some parts of the wall. A towel and a washcloth with blood on them had been left near the master bedroom. The luminol also showed a path of bloody left footprints leading to the master bedroom, and there were more luminol footprints on the front porch and leading from the carport to the driveway. The killer had left behind a rubber glove tip in a doorway between the living room and the hallway, and they knew that this tip had not come from a dishwashing glove or one of the technician's gloves. It matched nothing in the house, and there was no reason for it to be there, unless someone had left it there on purpose to send a message. And this is where we get into, just briefly, how it has been compared to the Jeffrey McDonald murders, and there have been some conspiracy theories about that, I guess you could call them.
Well, I mean, there's certainly parallels.
Some.
We're all familiar with the McDonald case where his wife, pregnant wife, and two children were killed just a small distance away from the Eastburn family.
Yes, and they were both captains, Jeffrey and Gary.
Right.
Right, but it happened 15 years earlier.
Yeah, but anyone who knew of that case or had read Fatal Vision, the book that Joe McGinnis wrote about McDonald, knew that Army investigators had found the finger of a surgeon's glove in the McDonald's bedroom, stained with Colette McDonald's blood.
Well, yeah, that glove piece had been used to write the word pig on the headboard of the bed, just above where Colette had been stabbed and clubbed to death. So it is strange that they found that there.
It is, isn't it?
Very. So there are a lot of things about this case I cannot explain.
I know.
Yeah.
Me either. But it's an interesting parallel.
It is.
And there was, I think we'll talk about a little bit further down the road, but there was some attempt to link the two.
Yes. Yeah, and I don't agree with it.
No.
I can disregard it after looking it over.
Definitely.
But I definitely do think it's odd.
Very odd. So police started their interviews with Julie Zerniak, who is the 15-year-old babysitter. She sat weeping on the Seafelt's porch. Julie said that she had gotten weird calls almost every time she babysat for the Eastburns. And this was ever since Gary had left for officer's school. That's when the calls had started coming. Mrs. Eastburn had even warned her about them.
She had. She had remarked about them to a few people, and Gary was aware of them.
Right, because she had told Gary.
Now, I don't think they threatened any violence, but they did have some sexual connotations. There was some talk that he was watching her and he was going to come over, whoever the caller was. So they were frightening.
They were. I mean, the last time she sat for the family was Tuesday, 5 days before, and someone had called and asked, "How's the most gorgeous girl on Summer Hill Road?" It's a little disconcerting.
It is. So I guess in 85, they were not able to trace calls like that unless they put a tracer on in advance, right?
I believe so.
Yeah, that's what I think.
I mean, and even if you'd left a message, you don't have any record or any way of finding out where it came from.
No. I mean, if my remembering 80s movies is correct, you had to get a bug put on the phone before the call came in order to try and trace it. And then they had to stay on the phone for a certain amount of time.
Right.
Yeah.
So, and there was another message that Julie had taken on Tuesday, and this was somebody named Angela who was looking to buy the family dog, Dixie. Now, the Eastburns apparently kept messages on the bulletin board above the phone. But when police searched, there were no messages to be found. And Julie said she couldn't remember them. "It freaks me out," Julie said. "It's just like Dr. McDonald." Here's where it gets a little interesting to me.
Yeah, very.
The Eastburns' babysitter explained that she had a friendship with Jeffrey McDonald, who was an innocent man, according to her. Julie was a member of Jeffrey McDonald's International Fan Club. How odd is that? More than odd. I mean, first we got the glove tip, and then the babysitter was a big fan of McDonald.
It is odd, but the more I think about it, I think if you lived in that area and you were familiar with the case, you probably did have kind of a fascination with it.
I think so. And,
but then
and you would certainly be either pro or con. It's tough to find somebody with neutral feelings about McDonald.
Absolutely, right. But to me, it goes above and beyond when we learn that she actually was in contact with him. She actually thought she had a friendship with him, and this friendship started when she was only in the eighth grade, and she chose to read Fatal Vision for a book report. Now, to me, that's an odd decision at that age to read that book.
Yes, it is.
But she read the whole book, which was nearly 700 pages, and some parts she would reread over and over. So she seems almost obsessed. One of these women, maybe, or girls that gets a crush on an inmate.
Mm-hmm.
We've seen that happen.
We have.
Plus, you know, Jeffrey McDonald was an impressive guy before the murders. Princeton graduate, Green Beret, doctor, kind of an all-American guy. And she believed there's no way he would have killed his wife and kids. Also, she didn't understand why they didn't arrest Helena Stokely for this. And that's the drug addict informant who had made some confessions about being there the night of the murders. And I don't want to go into it too much, but her fascination with McDonald didn't end when she completed that book report. She wanted to know more about him and the case for years afterwards. She wanted to find out what he was really like, so she wrote to him in prison. And just a few days later, the first of more than a dozen letters from Jeffrey McDonald arrived at her house. He said it was good to hear from her. He was trying to stay in shape and keep his mind active, he said. And he said his chances for a new trial were pretty good. He also said, when I get out, I have to come see you, to an eighth grade girl. Julie said she wanted to be McDonald's third daughter, and he agreed if he ever had another daughter, he would want her to be like Julie.
You know, I'm kind of gagging.
So that makes me think he's a real creep.
No kidding.
I wonder how many girls he was writing with. I bet there were a lot.
Well, there's more than one.
Yeah, that's for sure.
So Julia decided that the book Fatal Vision was just a bunch of lies.
Which is a fair opinion. That's okay to have that opinion.
In her opinion, Jeffrey McDonald was a very caring, sensitive person. And unless he was just totally freaked out somehow, she claimed, he couldn't have done the murders in a normal state of mind. 10 weeks before the Eastburn murders, McDonald had actually called Collect to wish Julia a happy 15th birthday.
Now, did her parents know about that? Holy shit.
Yeah, I know.
If there's a convict calling my 15-year-old daughter, I would not be happy.
No.
No, I mean, creepy.
It is, because this guy, at that point, was, what, 25, 30 years older than her?
Yeah. It's yucky, isn't it?
Oh, just makes my skin crawl.
Yeah. So as detectives were leaving the neighborhood, 20-year-old Patrick Cohn walked to the top of Summerhill Road and waited, because this guy knew he was going to have to tell police what he'd seen Thursday night, or early Friday morning. Now, he wasn't sure that he wanted to expose his private life to the police. He was a guy who stayed out late with friends and sometimes drank too much. This was a young African-American guy. Like I said, he was only 20. But he knew right from wrong, and he knew somebody might remember seeing him on the street that night. So Cohn waved his arms as a sheriff deputy drove by. And Deputy Eddie Hollinsworth pulled over. And Cohn said to him, I saw somebody leaving the house that night. He said he was walking home from his girlfriend's house about 3:30 a.m., He detailed his walk home that took him past the Eastburns' home. As he was walking, he saw a white Chevette parked on the road. Then he saw a white guy walking down the Eastburns' driveway, and he passed right by him, and he watched this man get into this white Chevette and drive off. Cohn said he could remember the man's face, his hair, his mustache. He described what the man had been wearing, a black members-only type jacket, a black toboggan hat, a white shirt, jeans, and tennis shoes. But he also remembered the guy was carrying a garbage bag over his shoulder. So this would be an important eyewitness as we get into this case.
He's going to be a very interesting witness.
Mm-hmm. So let's go back and talk a little bit about Gary, how Gary got this news, because this is a horrible thing that happened to him too, of course. Now, we know he didn't like leaving his family behind, but he decided it was the right thing to do. The Air Force had offered him this chance to go to Squadron Officer School, and if he wanted to get promoted, he needed to do this.
Well, sure, because if you're going to be moving on up in rank and stuff, you're going to do these.
Yeah, these are sacrifices you make, right?
Right.
Katie called Gary at 8 a.m. every Saturday, and she wrote to him during the week, and this was their routine. The kids would take turns on the phone talking to Gary when she called. So he waited for her call by the hall phone in his dormitory on Saturday, May 11th, and he became impatient and made the decision that one collect call home wouldn't break the family budget. So at 8:15, he dialed his house, and there was no answer. He had to go on a run with his squad after that, but he returned to the phone around 11:15 a.m., and there was still no answer. This is when he started to worry.
Yeah, so he called Dale Johnson, who was a sergeant working for him at Pope Air Force Base in North Carolina, and he asked him to take a look around the house. Dale called him back and said there's nobody home. So then Dale called the sheriff's department for Gary and asked them to leave a message. So the sheriff's deputy, Brenda Price, went to the house, found no one home. She's the one who wrote the note that was left in the door. And she talked to the next-door neighbor, who was Robert Seafelt. She asked him if he had seen anything unusual next door. Now, he was kind of half asleep on his sofa, but said he hadn't seen anything. Then Gary received a call from a detective the next day, Sunday, May 12th. And all he was told was that there was a death in the family, and he needed to come home to Fayetteville immediately. A chaplain spoke with the detective, and he told Gary that his youngest daughter, Jana, was alive. Well, so Gary's already figured out that that means that his other two daughters and his wife are dead, right?
Yeah, so he was never really a suspect because he was away, of course. There was no sign that he had a motive to want to kill his family or that he would have hired anyone to do this.
Yeah, and just the timing of things. It was physically impossible for him to have gotten home, done the killings, and returned to the base in Alabama.
Well, he did say one thing a little suspicious in the beginning. As soon as he picked up the phone, he said, "How many of them are dead?" But, you know, he was a smart guy. He knew that when a detective called him and no one's answering the phone, that something bad had happened.
Yeah, I wouldn't think it was terribly weird. He already knows that something bad's happened.
He does.
Something is seriously amiss at his house.
Exactly.
So.
But at first it did seem a bit strange, that's all.
Yeah.
Gary's plane landed in North Carolina at about 11:30 that night. He climbed into an Air Force transport car and immediately asked to see his surviving daughter. But instead, he was taken to the Cumberland County Sheriff's Department, where they questioned him until 2 a.m. Before he could go to Jana, he had to provide head and pubic hair samples to compare against those found in the house.
Now, Jana had been taken to Womack Army Hospital on Fort Bragg. She was severely dehydrated because she'd been without food or water for 3 days. Neighbor Jeanette Seafelt had been taking care of her ever since Toman rescued her from the crib. Jeanette had cleaned her up and put her in one of her husband's T-shirts. She fed her some crackers, which she immediately threw up.
So what about dehydration? 3 days. She could have died in 3 days.
She could have, yeah.
I wonder how she survived.
She's not quite two.
She's a baby.
So she's been without any fluids or nutrition for close to 3 days. Yeah.
Maybe she had a bottle in the crib?
Possibly, but in any event, I mean, she couldn't have held out much longer.
No, they said she was hours from death. Although the fact that she was standing and crying is impressive to me. I mean, we've seen dehydrated babies, and usually they're just limp.
So Gary was taken throughout his home, which was now a crime scene, to see if he noticed anything missing. Now, he said that there's a metal lockbox holding his family's important papers. That was gone. There was $300 of Christmas money that had been in Katie's drawer, chest of drawers. That was gone. And her wallet was gone. Gary said his wife kept her bank machine card in her wallet.
Yeah, and she also kept her PIN on a little piece of paper in that wallet, which they tell you not to do.
Right, but that's how a person got to use the card.
Right. So Gary was asked whether he was aware that Katie was rehoming their dog. Katie had written a letter to Gary the night before she was killed, telling him that she had found a home for their dog, Dixie. A nice man came and took Dixie, she wrote. She had planned to find Dixie a home as soon as Gary left for Alabama. But with those strange phone calls, she'd kept Dixie around a little bit longer as a watchdog. He and Katie had agreed to advertise Dixie in the Beeline Grab Brag, a Trading Post newspaper on Fort Bragg. So the ad was pretty simple. It said, English setter, 5 years, spayed, no papers, $10.
Okay, let's take a quick break here for our sponsors.
Ring in the new year with a new hair care routine with Madison Reed, a company founded by a woman who is on a mission to revolutionize the way women color their hair. I've been using Madison Reed hair color for over a year now, and my hair feels very soft and healthy. Plus, it looks really great. Dick always says so.
It certainly does.
Madison Reed costs less than $25, and it's delivered to me at my home on my schedule. It saves me time, money, and I don't have to scrimp on quality, ever. Remember, it's 2019. You don't have to choose between outdated box color or the time and expense of a salon. With Madison Reed, you'll look like you went to the salon, but you'll have me time to do the things that you love. It's crafted in Italy by master colorists, and it's a professional hair care color that you can easily do at home. It's multi-tonal, ammonia-free, and made with ingredients that you can feel really good about. You can find your perfect shade at madison-reed.com. Madison Reed is honoring True Crime Brewery listeners with 10% off and free shipping on your first color kit with promo code BREWERY. That's madison-reed.com. And use promo code BREWERY to get 10% off plus free shipping. The code again is BREWERY.
Today's episode is also sponsored by ADT. ADT can design and install a smart home just for you backed by 24/7 protection. This gives you a new smart home at your service that is customized for your individual lifestyle. With a secure ADT smart home, you can set up custom automations unique to your home to automatically do things like lock the doors and set the thermostat when you leave. You can even close the garage door from virtually anywhere.
What I really appreciate is that I can turn on the outdoor lights from wherever I am to make the house look occupied, even when it isn't. And it's all controlled from the ADT app on my phone or the sound of my voice. And again, I have ADT's 24/7 protection. ADT does the installation and configuration of your system too, so you don't have to worry about that.
ADT can set up your home with multiple smart home devices and security features like indoor and outdoor cameras, locks, lights, and garage door control, even video doorbells.
I love technology.
Fun stuff. Visit ADT.com/smart to learn more about how ADT can design and install a secure smart home just for you. That's ADT.com/smart.
Katie Eastburn knew that she and her girls would miss their family and friends in North Carolina, but they were especially heartbroken about having to leave their family dog, Dixie, behind. There were government regulations that prohibited them from bringing their dog along. Plus, if you bring your dog overseas, it's really traumatic for them.
Well, they're going to be quarantined.
Yeah.
So it's not a great thing for the pet.
No, I never feel like flying your dog is easy.
Yeah, not even domestic.
No. So Katie placed the classified ad in the local paper, and she thought she'd found a good family who was willing to take Dixie and love her as much as her family did. Around 9 p.m. on Tuesday, May 7th, Army Staff Sergeant Tim Hennis answered her classified ad. He and his wife Angela loved dogs, but their current dog was very jealous of their newborn daughter. So they tried obedience training, but Snowball, a mixed dog, just wasn't going to work out. So they hoped to find another dog, one from a home with kids who would be better with babies and kids. And Dixie seemed to be everything that Tim and Angela had been hoping for. So before he left the Eastburn home, Tim asked Katie if he could use the family's bathroom. So he did that, and then he left soon after with Dixie in tow on a leash that he'd brought with him.
Patrick Cohn had given police a description of the man he saw outside at the Eastburn house the night of May 9th. 3 days after the murders, the police broadcasted a request on TV and radio for the man who had answered the Eastburns' ad for their dog. They also showed the police sketch. So Tim and Angela Hennis looked at that, and they realized that the police were looking for him. Tim called the sheriff's office to tell him he was on his way. Sounds like he has nothing to fear.
He seems very upfront in the beginning, doesn't he?
He does.
So Tim was one of the last people to see Katie Eastburn alive. Plus, he looked just like that police sketch. He gave a statement describing his actions and whereabouts between May 9th and May 12th. Hennis said he had dropped off his wife at Selma, which was 90 minutes away, on Thursday, May 9th, so she could visit with her parents for Mother's Day weekend. Because he had CQ duty on Friday and Sunday night, they wouldn't have much time together if she stayed there. CQ duty was 24-hour shifts at the barracks, so somebody had to be in charge in case a supervisor was needed in the middle of the night.
CQ is charge of quarters.
Very good. Hennis said he returned to Fayetteville without Angela and went to bed early, just a short time after Katie had called to see if Dixie, the dog, was working out okay. He had a normal work day on Friday, Hennis said, then CQ duty that night. He said he cleaned up around the house on Saturday, then he had CQ duty again on Sunday, and he picked up his wife Angela on Monday. He gave hair, saliva, and blood samples before he left the station. Hair, blood, and fingerprints had been found in the Eastburn home, but during the autopsy, the medical examiner also had a semen sample with a large number of intact spermatozoa. So Hennis completed the rape kit, where he had to comb and pull out head and pubic hairs, and he had to spit into a cup for a saliva sample. He also had to have blood drawn. He asked if he was a suspect, but he was told no. The detective stalled him, though, until a fingerprint expert could drive in from Raleigh to get his fingerprints. While Hennis was being detained, Patrick Cohn came in to do a photo lineup. So Cohn chose Hennis from photos of six men who were blonde with mustaches. The thing about this is, though, he's of a different race, And as we know, identification is not as accurate if you're identifying someone of a different race. It's like a 45% accuracy rate. It is a fact that cross-racial identification does not have the same accuracy as identifying someone who's your own race.
Beyond that, I'm just maybe not skeptical, but I'm a little leery of any eyewitness description.
Oh, absolutely. I think it's very easy to misidentify, misremember. Eyewitnesses are just the worst.
And you're wanting to help?
Yeah.
And you can sense from the police, I think, who they're looking at.
Maybe. I don't know about that, but I am with you, and it's not the best evidence to me. But it was kind of helpful. He also identified the white Chevette in the parking lot.
Yeah, he seemed to know a good deal.
He did. I mean, despite everything we just said, he did seem very reliable as a witness. Angela and Tim left the station with their baby daughter, and they were surrounded by reporters and cameras. But they went to bed that night, trying to put the experience behind them. At least Angela did. None of us know what was in Tim Hennis's mind that night.
Now, the Cumberland County Sheriff's Department wanted to arrest Hennis immediately and be able to announce that the case had been solved. The district attorney recommended that they wait, but they were eager to show the public that the killer was in custody. And particularly if you're talking about a copycat killer from the McDonald case. I mean, you don't want to have people thinking that there's a killer roaming Fort Bragg.
No.
So they got a warrant for Hennis's arrest and warrants to search his house and car. 1 o'clock in the morning, they pounded on the Hennis's door and arrested Tim. Angela called Tim's father, Bob. Bob and Mary Lou Hennis were very supportive parents, and Bob headed to the airport to come to the aid of his son.
Yeah, they were down in Florida, right?
Right.
So Bob and Mary Lou had adopted all three of their children and raised them in their Minnesota home on 5 acres. Tim was 2 and a half when he was adopted. His brother Andy, 3 years younger than Tim, and his sister Beth, 4 and a half years younger, were adopted also in the next 2 years. These kids had a happy childhood with loving parents by all accounts. They had a pool table, a ping pong table, a swimming pool. Beth actually had horses, and the family took weekend camping trips.
Yeah, there isn't anything that suggests that they had a tough upbringing.
No. By 1982, Tim was in the Army, Andy was engaged, and Beth was almost out of school, and Bob was transferred to Boca Raton. Andy and Beth would move there to be near their parents. But Andy headed to Florida on June 23rd on his motorcycle. He exited off I-285 and stopped at a red light. And he was waiting behind a line of cars for the light to turn when a drunk driver hit him from behind. Andy was knocked into the next lane and he was killed by a tractor trailer.
Horrible accident.
Yeah.
So police are searching the home of Tim and Angela Hennis. They didn't find any knives or bloody towels. But in Tim and Angela's bedroom, they did find 2 black toboggan caps. They didn't find a dark-colored jacket, which was the piece of clothing that Patrick Conant first described. They tested every shoe Hennis had in his closet with phenolphthalein. This is a substance that's more precise than luminol because it reacts only to blood. They tested the knives in his house and a pair of tan corduroys from a dresser drawer. Then they also seized the white Chevette. At the county garage, they went through the car with luminol, spraying around the mess of fast food wrappers, soda cans, and newspapers. No blood was found in the car. The only hair that they found belonged to Dixie.
Yeah, the dog.
So Bob took Angela to lunch, and then they went to the law office of H. Gerald Beaver. Bob wanted to hire Beaver for Tim's case. Beaver had met Tim that morning after Mary Lou called him from Boca Raton, and he felt that Tim seemed innocent of the crime, but he was well aware that the district attorney had a strong circumstantial case against him.
Then there was more bad news. A neighbor called the sheriff's department to report some of Tim's unusual activity the day before the Eastburns' bodies were found. This neighbor had seen Tim drag a 55-gallon barrel from the corner of his lot over to near his house. And by 9:30 a.m., smoke was pouring from the barrel. Flames shot into the air as Hennis stood over it, pouring in lighter fluid to maintain the fire. He also stirred the fire with a stick. And later in the afternoon, he came back and restarted the fire again.
To me, while that's circumstantial evidence, it's significant.
Very suspicious.
Right, because he'd never done this before. And suddenly the day after the crime, the murders, he's burning something in this big drum.
Yeah. So Beaver told Bob and Angela the state would argue the barrel fire explained why no bloody clothes, towels, or rags had been found inside Hennis's home. The lawyers knew lab experts could match some burn remains to any known documents. Remember, there were papers that were taken. And they thought that maybe something in that barrel would help them convict Tim Hennis. But Bob immediately hired the law firm of Beaver, Holt, Richardson, Sternlicht, Burge, and Glazier. Two of their senior partners, Beaver and Richardson, were considered the best criminal defense attorneys in North Carolina. So I think the court was surprised that he had such a good attorney. They didn't expect that with this young guy who didn't have much.
Well, yeah. I mean, he's an Air Force sergeant.
Yep.
Not enough to hire a fancy defense attorney.
I guess it pays to have parents with money.
Yeah. Bob was an IBM exec. Yes. So he probably was fairly well off.
Yeah, I think so. But still, it seems like they had to sell their house. There was like a $100,000 retainer. So it wasn't like they just had the money to blow. They did have to make sacrifices.
Oh, they certainly did.
Yeah.
So the law firm hired an investigator named Bob Nelligar. And his job was to retrace the steps of police detectives, scrutinize the evidence, and look for information or clues that police might have missed. So Nelligar and the attorney set up a reenactment of the scene, as described by Patrick Cohn. And along with the Tim Hennis lookalike, they went to the Summerhill Road residence at the same early morning time. The Patrick stand-in was unable to see the Tim lookalike because the area was very poorly lit during the pre-dawn hours.
Yes, and then there was videotape of Patrick Cohn himself saying he couldn't see, you know, doubting what he had said.
And then during this reenactment, David Hill, who is a neighbor from across the street, approached the team and told them that on the night of the murder, he had approached a van parked in front of the Eastburn residence. He'd spoken to a white male with a crew cut who said he had stopped to talk with a couple friends whose voices David could hear in the back of the van. Now, the van drove off before they could do anything. And then a couple days later, David saw the same van for sale in a Winn-Dixie parking lot.
But that just seems like a red herring to me.
Well, it seems convenient, doesn't it?
I think it's just one of these people trying to help who might not have any information that matters too much, but...
There was a second reenactment that failed to prove the eyewitness testimony. So Patrick did admit that he's been starting to have doubts about his identification of Tim Hennis. Nelliger also found flaws in the evidence, including hairs and fingerprints found at the scene that could not be matched to Hennis or any known friend or family member of the Eastburn family. There was also a size 9 shoe print uncovered by police that was much smaller than Tim's size 13 feet.
Now, I've read that he had a size 11, he had a size 12, he had a size 13, so I'm not sure what his shoe size was. But it was definitely larger than a 9.
Yeah, but there was also some question about whether that was the whole print. It might have been missing part of the heel or part of the toe.
So,
again, there's a lot of contradictory stuff going on here.
There is. That's why it's so hard to make up my mind about this case. Forensic expert Paul Stombaugh visited the Eastburn residence 6 months after the crime. He found a condom package that was undiscovered by police underneath the dresser. According to him, when compared to known facts about the relationship between the Eastburns, this suggested that consensual sex had happened in the home prior to the murders. So he's suggesting that Katie had sex with someone else in her home while her husband was away. After spending time in the Eastburn home and reviewing reports and evidence, he also suggested that the murders were committed by two assailants. And how did he come up with that? It was because of the wounds, the direction the wounds came from?
He's looking at the wounds. He's first of all thinking that there was more than one weapon, more than one knife.
Okay.
And as you said, the directions of the slashes suggested some were done by a right-handed person and some possibly by a left-handed person.
So did this go along with the whole idea that it was a McDonald-planned thing to try and get him to win his appeal? To make it look like there was a killer out there doing these crimes?
Well, that's the implication, isn't
that's
it?
That's what I thought, yeah.
And the interesting thing about Stombaugh is he was one of the star witnesses in the McDonald trial.
For what side?
For the prosecution, not the defense. He's the one who lined up the pajama top so that all the holes in it could match.
Uh-huh.
So he was somewhat instrumental in convicting McDonald. And now he's working for the defense and is suggesting that the murders were kind of a copycat killing. But it turned out, and I don't know exactly how, from reading the book or listening to the other sources we had, the defense decided that his evidence or his testimony wasn't going to be very helpful.
So they didn't really use it at trial.
So he didn't testify for the defense.
Okay.
And the other thing is that Nelligar also spoke with a Lucille Cook. And this was a woman who had used her ATM card at the same time and place when Katie's card had been used. She said she saw nobody during her transaction. The first time was at 10:52 p.m. on Friday, May 10th, which is the night after the murders. Then the card was used again the next morning at 8:56. Each time, somebody withdrew $150. The interesting thing here is that Hennis needed about $300 to pay his rent for his house or
yeah,
his apartment.
He wasn't good with money, and he'd gotten in trouble for writing bad checks a couple of times. Now, the thing about this woman is she said that she saw no one, but then she would go back on that and tell the prosecution she'd seen a tall blonde guy.
Months later.
Plus, she used the machine 3 minutes after him. Why would he hang around for 3 minutes?
There's no reason to.
So, I don't really find her reliable.
3 minutes is a long time.
It is when you're standing in an ATM.
Yep.
And you think if somebody had killed people and was using the card, they'd want to get the heck out of there quickly.
No kidding. So police and prosecutors were sticking to their belief that Tim was guilty. And they investigated him, and they uncovered an incident at Bennigan's, one of those chain restaurants, where Hennis worked part-time in the kitchen. He had apparently lost his temper, backed an employee against a wall, all in a dispute over cleanup. They also got a report that Tim and Angela Hennis fought the day before the murders while they were in a hobby class learning how to build a dollhouse for Christina. The report said that embarrassed classmates had stopped and stared at the couple, so I guess it was a bit of a vigorous argument.
This kind of behavior is definitely a red flag that shows that a person has issues. Now, I once had a girlfriend who was dating a guy who worked in a restaurant, and he got into an altercation and actually squirted his boss or one of his coworkers with a hose outside the door of the restaurant and got in a fight with them.
Yeah.
And I told her, don't marry this guy. He has issues with anger. Well, suffice it to say, he had a lot of issues and she ended up divorcing him.
But she didn't listen to your advice.
No, she never did. But okay. at least I could say I had told her.
The prosecutors also checked Hennis's military record, and they learned that he had been kicked out of helicopter flight school because he was lying to a captain. So maybe Hennis had a grudge against officers, and maybe he took out his revenge on Captain Gary Eastburn's family.
Well, a lot of people who talked to him said he was the kind of guy with a chip on his shoulder.
Yeah, that's kind of a long shot for me.
That he had something against...
Yeah, I'm just going to go kill an officer's family.
Oh, I don't think he'd do it for that reason, but that could be part of it. You know, that could be part of... let's say that he wanted to have sex with her and she said no, and he could say, oh, you think you're too good for me? You're a captain's wife. That could be part of his anger.
Sure.
Sure.
Now, the Army did have jurisdiction over Hennis because he was on active duty, and they could have court-martialed him on murder charges. But the crime had been committed off-base, and this was normally prosecuted by the county. So the Army didn't have anything to do with this case.
The first one.
The first case.
The first trial.
And Hennis's alibi, that he returned home immediately after dropping off his wife and daughter at his in-laws, was disproved when Nancy Macer, a former girlfriend, told detectives a totally different story.
So Hennis and Macer had actually met years earlier at a honky-tonk bar in Fort Bragg, and they dated for a while. And after they broke up, Hennis still occasionally stopped by her house. On May 9th, Hennis, aware that her husband was deployed away in Germany, made an unannounced visit. Nancy Macer said that she let him in and they talked, and she tapped his wedding band and asked him how his marriage was going. And he told her that his wife had left him.
Well, that's not true.
Well, I mean, technically, she's at her parents' for a couple days.
Oh, okay.
So,
yeah, I guess
he may have been misleading her there.
Technically speaking, she had left him.
Right.
Just for the weekend.
But he may have had some interest in sexual activity with her. Although she says he didn't come on to her and he left, he was in a fine mood. He wasn't angry or frustrated or anything, which is what the prosecution would try and say. They actually decided that he was rejected by Nancy Mazur and he'd gone to see this other attractive woman that he knew was home alone, Katie Eastburn. So maybe he was rejected by Katie, things got out of control. Now it's hard to believe they would get out of control to the point where he would kill two children and her.
Yeah.
But it did happen, so somebody did it.
Someone did. So then the morning, Friday morning after the murders, Hennis had taken a single item of clothing to the dry cleaners, which turned out to be his black members only jacket.
Which was suspicious.
Yeah, one article.
Although I guess there was no blood on it.
No.
And how do they know that?
They know that from, well, it's circumstantial stuff. The dry cleaner said that he didn't notice any blood stains. And Hennis did not ask to have blood stains removed from the jacket. It just was regular cleaning.
So if there was blood on there and it had the regular cleaning, and then the police tested it after the cleaning, would they still have found blood if it had been there, is the question.
They would have.
And they know that for sure?
Yeah, that was testimony down the road in the other trial.
Yeah, I find that strange, because even if you just have regular dry cleaning, it seems like various things are going to come off of it without special treatments.
Sure, but you could still recover evidence of blood.
Okay.
You have to use a special cleaner, apparently, to remove blood stains.
Okay. So a month before the case went to trial, another eyewitness emerged. Investigators tracked down that woman who visited the ATM 3 minutes after the stolen card had been used on Saturday morning. And this is when she recalled seeing a tall man with blonde hair, wearing camouflage pants, and getting into a small light-colored car.
Yeah, this is the woman who initially said she saw nobody.
Right, and then she came forward a month before the trial.
Yeah.
And changed her mind, which is really weird. You almost wonder if the police had worked with her to get that out of her or something.
One would say so.
Now, before the trial, Hennis was offered a plea bargain. 2 counts of second-degree murder, with a likely penalty of 2 consecutive life sentences. But he told his lawyer, "I'm not pleading guilty to something I didn't do." So maybe he was innocent, or maybe he felt that they didn't have enough evidence to convict him.
One or the other.
Yeah, or both. At the trial, in the summer of 1986, the lead prosecutor, William Van Story, told the jurors, "What happened in that house was utter madness. It's one of the most tragic things that has ever happened in this country." And he showed dozens of gruesome photographs from the crime scene. Now, they actually set up one of those slideshows with not only pictures from the crime scene, but pictures of the girls on the autopsy tables, which seems unnecessary to prove anything.
Yeah, and the other thing is that the screen for showing this was directly behind Hennis.
Oh.
So when they were showing pictures, the jury's not only looking at the slides, but they can see Hennis underneath them.
And what does he do? I mean, if he has a blank look on his face, he looks cold.
Yeah.
He looks upset. He looks guilty.
You're screwed either way.
Yeah. So that really did make him look bad.
On July 4th, 1986, after 12 hours of deliberation, the jury returned a guilty verdict on 1 count of first-degree rape and 3 counts of first-degree murder. Tim Hennis was sentenced to death 3 times. While the defense prepared an appeal, Hennis was moved upstate to a prison in Raleigh. He was one of 17 convicts on death row. At the facility, Hennis received a letter, postmarked July 8th, the day of his sentencing. "Dear Mr. Hennis, I did the crime. I murdered the Eastburns. Sorry you're doing the time. I'll be safely out of North Carolina when you read this. Thanks, Mr. X."
Authorities never determined Mr. X's identity. The sheriff's office also received a Mr. X letter, and one was sent to an attorney named Deaver, because whoever it was confused Beaver and Deaver. Hennis's appeal reached the state Supreme Court, where Hennis's lawyers argued that the many graphic photos shown by the prosecution had unduly inflamed the jurors against his client. And the judges ruled 5-2 in Hennis's favor, so he was awarded a retrial.
Yeah, and there was also some prosecutorial misconduct in terms of prosecution was withholding evidence that they had that showed that Hennis was at work at the time of the usage of the ATM card, which might have helped exonerate him.
Sure.
So we're going to have a new trial.
Yeah, the Hennis ruling is still invoked by defense attorneys seeking to limit the presentation of photos that are redundant or that could unfairly prejudice jurors. So there's just an interesting legal tidbit.
Well, just from reading the book and looking into things, it certainly was above and beyond the amount of pictures that they needed.
Absolutely.
And
yeah.
The defense was willing to stipulate how the victims had died. I mean, there wasn't anything that could be gained by showing the photos except to make people feel terrible.
Right, exactly. It's true, because they weren't arguing that the family had died the way they died.
Right.
Right. So at the retrial in Wilmington, the defense focused on discrediting Patrick Cohn, the eyewitness. Beaver referred to him as a thief and a liar. Between the first and second trials, Cohn had committed some fairly minor criminal offenses, attempting to use a stolen ATM card, public drunkenness, obstructing an officer, driving a car with an expired registration. And during this drunkenness episode, he told a cop, "You can't arrest me, I'm helping you guys out." So he was kind of using his status as a witness to keep out of trouble when he did things wrong. And he went back and forth on whether he had actually seen Hennis.
One day he was positive of his identification. The next day he wasn't sure. He just vacillated back and forth.
He did.
Hennis's lawyers also argued that Cohn's testimony at the first trial was inaccurate. Cohn had said that the weather on the night of the murders was fair, with stars out. A meteorologist called by the defense provided records that showed it had been a cloudy night. A local helicopter pilot, who had aborted a medevac mission that same morning, also remembered the weather being very, very dark, overcast.
On the stand, Gary Eastburn confirmed that 2 months before Hennis picked up their dog, Katie had received threatening phone calls in the middle of the night from a man who knew her name and said that he was coming over to the house. Then they also read the unsettling letters from Mr. X. The defense emphasized that just a couple of weeks after the murders, the woman who testified to seeing a man resembling Hennis at the ATM had told an investigator, "I don't remember anything." She apparently firmed up her story on the eve of the first trial, assuring prosecutors that she had seen a tall blonde man getting into a compact white car. So Beaver called this highly suspect.
Two new witnesses also testified on Hennis's behalf. One was a woman who delivered the Raleigh News and Observer paper every morning, and she said that at 1:45 that night, she had seen a long-haired man driving a light-colored van in front of the Eastburn home. The defense then called a tall, blonde teenage boy from the Eastburn's neighborhood to the stand, and he testified that he often walked along Summer Hill Road late at night, and he admitted to doing so around 3 in the morning on May 10, 1985. This suggested that maybe he was the person Cohn saw, not Hennis. And then the boy appeared in court. The room just grew very silent because he was almost identical to Hennis.
He was. This was a big deal. The defense had the footprints, too, that were found outside the Eastman house and were several sizes smaller than Hennis's shoes. And there was blood discovered on a bathroom towel that didn't match Hennis's blood. Investigators had found several hairs, including a pubic hair, in the Eastman home that belonged to neither Hennis nor any of the victims. As for the fire that Hennis set in his backyard the day after the murder, the defense showed that nothing in the charred remains had been traced to the Eastburn home. Not only did Hennis's members-only jacket have no bloodstains, there was an analyst from the International Fabric Care Institute that testified that Varsol, the chemical used in regular dry cleaning, could not remove all traces of blood.
On April 10, 1989, Hennis took the stand. Beaver and Richardson recommended it as they felt that their client had nothing to hide. So this was the same defense team that recommended he not testify at the first trial.
Right.
But this time they did.
Yeah, and he rehearsed to not lose his temper. And he did okay, but he still had some kind of angry responses.
Well, I think he's that kind of guy.
Yeah, it seems like it.
But when Hennis was asked about not telling detectives at first about his visit with Nancy Macer, he said, "I forgot about it, sir. I just didn't place that much emphasis on it. It is something that slipped my mind."
I have a hard time believing that.
Me too, but that's okay.
After 2 days of deliberations, the jury reached a verdict not guilty on all counts. So after living for more than 800 days on death row, Hennis left the courthouse as a free man. He lifted up his daughter Christina, who was now 4 years old, and several jurors actually came out and shook his hand.
So after his acquittal, Hennis re-enlisted. Basically, he didn't have anything else to do besides be in the service.
Right. That's true. I mean, what are you going to do?
Right. He received 3 years of back pay, a good conduct medal, and a promotion to staff sergeant. In September 1990, he went to Saudi Arabia for Operation Desert Shield. He returned to the United States the following spring, and then a year later went to Somalia. He received awards for his service. One superior described him as a sterling example for all, and a colleague called him an outstanding soldier. Jeff Schardiger, who served with Hennis at Fort Drum in New York, said, "Tim was a gentle giant. I would trust the guy with my family."
In 1998, Hennis, along with Angela, Christina, and now Andrew, his 6-year-old son, moved to Fort Lewis, Washington. So he's living free all this time. He became the scoutmaster of Andrew's troop, leading the boys on hiking trips to Mount St. Helens and on a snow-caving expedition. The assistant scoutmaster would remember Hennis as a good influence on the children. He retired from the Army in July 2004 after 23 years of service, and he'd earned the rank of Master Sergeant. Then he took a job at a waste treatment facility.
Right, but meanwhile, back in North Carolina all these years, prosecutors were continuing to pursue the case because they were convinced of Hennis's guilt.
Yeah, I don't know if they did much looking for other people.
No, they didn't.
Yeah, okay.
Now, in 2006, they found vaginal swabs from the rape kit taken from Katie Eastburn's body. And this gave them new evidence. DNA testing that hadn't been used in the 1980s. So it turned out that the semen found in Katie's vagina wasn't pursued as evidence. Technological advances, obviously, had improved in DNA testing. The semen sample was tested, and it showed with a 12 billion to 1 certainty that the semen from that swab belonged to Hennis.
Right, but there's been some people complaining about that evidence and saying it wasn't accurate because there were some issues.
There were, and this is a time when there was a lot of turmoil at the state lab, falsifying evidence and so on. But they tested a second sample at an independent lab and got the same results.
And a third sample. So I'm pretty convinced by this DNA evidence. I can't argue it.
No, it's Hennis.
But some of the things that were going on in that lab, Dwayne Deaver was behind it. We remember Dwayne Deaver from the Michael Peterson case.
Yeah, he screwed that up.
Yeah, he's the one that got Michael Peterson a new trial. But I'm going to go ahead and believe that DNA evidence.
Well, I think it's more believable with two other independent labs.
Right.
Verifying the testing.
And the problems were not within the DNA portion of the lab. It was blood testing and other things.
Right. Now, so you have that, but at the same time, you have a guy who has been cleared.
Right.
He's acquitted. So
what do you do?
We have this thing called double jeopardy, right? You can't be tried again for a crime that you've been acquitted.
Yeah, so they figured out a way to do this. And a lot of people don't think it was really fair.
Well, there was a team of military attorneys that evaluated the case, and the Army decided to pursue it. So they recalled Hennis to active duty, and he's back in the service, and then he gets charged with murder, 3 counts. So Major Rob Stella of the Army JAG Corps, Judge Advocate General Corps, worked on Hanna's case, and he stated that the military's ability to prosecute a case that had already been tried is well-settled law. Nothing the state does actually affects what the federal government can do.
Well, that may be very true, but it's still not something that is ever really done.
No, although, you know, I kind of can see it, because we have people that have been, you know, if you look at the opposite side of it, you have people on death row that have been convicted years before, and with new techniques in DNA technology, they find that the person on death row couldn't have been the perpetrator of the crime, and they get released.
Right, and
so,
with the...
So what's the difference then in someone who's previously been acquitted with new techniques in DNA testing, finding him to be the guilty party?
Well, you just don't want people to be harassed and taken back to court over and over again. But I could see with this new technology, it does kind of make sense. I know that some other countries have changed their double jeopardy laws. Australia, for example, just did it like 10 or 12 years ago. And it does kind of make sense. If you find DNA evidence, maybe there needs to be some kind of allowance for that. But this way, they kind of found their way around it by using the military.
I mean, at first glance, it sounds kind of a sneaky way to do it.
Kind of.
But I really can see. I mean, if they hadn't come up with new testing, he'd still be free.
Right.
So.
Well, and a lot of people think he should be, though. Well, the prosecution's case to court-martial Hennis was primarily based on that new DNA testing. In the defense's closing argument, his new attorney, Frank Spinner, urged jurors not to convict Hennis. He noted that there was no blood, fingerprint, or fiber evidence that connected Hennis to the crime, and that Hennis had been seen working on that dollhouse for his young daughter at the time of the bank transaction records, showing the stolen ATM card had been used. So I guess he'd been putting shingles on that dollhouse while he was at CQ duty that night.
Right, at least trying to put shingles on.
Spinner even suggested that it was possible there was no rape at all, but that Katie Eastburn and Tim Hennis had consensual sex a couple of days before she and her children were murdered by some other unknown person or persons.
Yeah, that really grossed people out.
Yes, it's attacking a victim. Also, if she did have sex with Tim Hennis, and then someone came and raped her after that, how likely is that?
No.
No.
But I don't think they're suggesting that.
I think they are.
Well, she was killed.
And raped. I think it's pretty sure she was raped, Dick, because they cut her panties.
Well, then there should be two people's DNA in there, right?
That's what I'm saying. Although they did find the condom package under the table. So I think they're suggesting that the rapist wore a condom.
Okay. But the whole thing is kind of contradictory. I mean, he's denied having sex with her. And if that... If they're trying to say it was consensual sex, then he'd be happy to have his sperm inside her because it was consensual.
Yeah. So you could say, why did he lie about that in the first trial, you mean?
Why did he lie about that?
Well, maybe they just didn't bring it up because it would look bad.
Huh.
I don't believe it.
No, I think that's a huge stretch.
And I think it really looked bad to say that.
Wasn't happily received, that's for sure.
No. So the jury came up with a guilty verdict, and they sentenced Hennis to death again. So now he's on death row at an Army facility in Fort Leavenworth, Kansas.
Yeah, he's had an appeal that's been denied. He has another appeal, I think, pending before a higher military court. And after that, it's the Supreme Court of the United States.
So he's not finished.
He's not finished. And the whole thing we didn't mention is that there's some DNA under the fingernails of Katie and the kids.
At least one of the kids.
One kid.
Yeah. Partial DNA.
Partial DNA. That's the tough part.
Which they say wasn't Hennis's.
It seems to exclude Hennis. So it's still a very fascinating case.
Yeah. The DNA in the sperm really makes me think he's guilty.
Yeah.
But at the same time, there are some questionable things.
For sure.
The evidence.
It's a fascinating case.
It really is. So we probably haven't heard the last of it.
Probably not.
So there are many sources of information on this case. There's a 2020 episode available on YouTube. There's also a book, Innocent Victims, by Scott Wisnett. And that was also made into a TV miniseries based on the book, which you can find on YouTube. There was also a documentary on CNN about the case, which was really very informative. And articles in The New Yorker, and you can find many articles also on abcnews.com.
Today's episode has been sponsored by ADT. ADT can design and install a smart home just for you, backed by 24/7 protection and controlled from the ADT app or the sound of your voice. Use your ADT app to monitor your cameras or video doorbell, and you can check on your home from virtually anywhere.
Very neat.
Pretty cool. Visit ADT.com/smart to learn more about how ADT can design and install a secure smart home just for you.
The music for True Crime Brewery is written and produced by Tristan Capel. If you would like more TCB in your life, you can go to our website, tiegrabber.com, and join Team Tiegrabber. And then you'll get access to our members-only episodes, which we do on every month. Along with this exclusive access to our large bank of members-only episodes, you'll receive a gift from us. You can also go to Patreon and become a patron of True Crime Brewery to get the same benefits. We recently covered the murders at White House Farm. Other members-only episodes include the Missing Grimes Sisters, Clara Harris, who drove over her dentist husband with the Mercedes, the heartbreaking story of Little Boy Blue, a boy killed by his Amish father, and the crimes of Philip Markoff, as well as the murder of Jill Cahill. That's just to name a few of them. Some other ways to show your support for True Crime Brewery are to follow us on Twitter at TiegrabberPods, on Instagram, TiegrabberPodcasts, and on Facebook. You can also join our True Crime Brewery fan discussions group on Facebook. And the action on there has been heating up. There's been a lot more on there lately. Some interesting discussions, not only of cases we've covered, but just of crime in general.
Yeah, it's a good read.
Yeah, it's fun. I know that you check it out daily. So let's move forward with feedback. Remember, you can send your feedback and case suggestions to us in an email to truecrimebrewery@tiegrabber.com, or tell us in your own voice by leaving a voicemail on the Leave a Voicemail link on the front page of our website, tiegrabber.com.
Yeah, and I think these are the last few voicemails that we've chosen to play that are going to be eligible to get a t-shirt. But I think the remaining voicemails have come after the first of the year.
Okay. We might want to talk about that. Maybe we'll want to expand it a little. We'll see.
We'll see.
We'll decide next
week.
These
are the ones I picked.
Okay.
So the first one is from Allie, and she has a case suggestion.
All right. Let's hear what Allie had to say.
Hi, Jill and Dick. My name is Allie, calling from Rochester, Minnesota. I'm calling with a case suggestion and a comment in regards to the Where's Heidi episode, but it's also regarding cases in general. So my comment is about the juror who decided to switch to the guilty verdict, mostly out of just, I guess, a gut feeling. And I feel like some people in society feel like they don't need hard evidence to convict somebody. Even when we're watching Netflix series or TV shows, we feel like, oh yeah, we have a gut feeling that that person's guilty, and that's enough to say, yeah, he did it, or yes, she did it. And I feel like when I talk to people about said cases, I try to explain, like, you can have a gut feeling that they did it, but that's not enough if you're a juror to say, yes, this person's guilty and you can send them away. It's okay to feel like somebody's guilty, but also if you were on the jury to say not guilty. It's okay to be in that middle grounds of the gray area where you have a gut feeling that they're guilty, but there's no physical evidence to put them away to jail. I feel like if people feel they're guilty, they automatically say throw them in jail, which isn't the correct way that our system's set up for this specific reason, that the Where's Heidi case provides evidence that just because you had the gut feeling, that person could be totally innocent. And it's proven later when the real evidence comes out. So that was just my comment based on that case. And several other cases have come out saying practically the exact same thing once we get more evidence that the person that we convicted is not the actual person who's guilty. So my case suggestion is regarding an older case. The lady's name is Helen Bronk. She disappeared from Rochester, in the Collar Hotel. It was in 1977, and she wasn't actually declared dead legally until 1984. And she was actually an heiress, so that was an interesting case because people fought over her money, and it was quite a scandal. So it's a very interesting case, and supposedly her ghost still haunts the hotel. So, and the Forger Brewery, which is also in Rochester, is a very good brewery, so I recommend a beer from there. We've been there a few times, and it's pretty packed all the time. So thank you.
All right. Thanks, Allie. So Allie brings up a disturbing point about our jury system.
Well, you know how we feel about juries.
But the bench trial, please.
The only thing I'd say about that is that you certainly can convict somebody on circumstantial evidence.
Circumstantial, yes, but not a feeling.
Right. And that's the part that I'm not sure is that frequent.
Oh, I don't know. I kind of see what she's saying. People do feel like they know things just from their intuition. But, you know, when you go to be a juror, you do get all kinds of warnings and instructions. So I would hope that most people listen to that.
Yeah, they don't.
No. I mean, a lot of people base it on, do they like the person?
Sure.
What is their feeling when they see the person? And I think most people know better than that. But I agree with Allie that a lot of people probably do that.
I think it factors in deliberations.
Absolutely.
No question. And that's why we've said before, and we'll say it again, if we're accused of something nasty like that, we're going to go for a bench trial.
And just hope we get a good judge.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, her case suggestion, we've talked about this before, so I'm thinking maybe we ought to do something about it. Helen Brock was a multimillionaire. Her wealth came from marrying into the E.J. Brock & Sons Candy Company. So she was very, very wealthy.
They make those delicious butterscotch things.
They do. Now she endowed the Helen V. Brock Foundation, which promoted animal welfare. And that began in 1974.
So she was a cool lady.
Well, just like you. So she disappeared in 1977. She was at the Mayo Clinic for something or other, and was supposed to be catching her flight back home to Chicago, and never apparently got on that flight. Then she was declared legally dead in May of 1984. There was an investigation of the case, and it uncovered some serious criminal activity associated with Chicago stable owners, Silas Jane and Richard Bailey. And Bailey was eventually charged with, but not convicted of, conspiring to murder Brock. And this was like 10 years after the fact.
So did they never find her body?
No, they've never found anything.
Okay.
Bailey did get a sentence after being convicted of defrauding Brock, but nobody else has been tried for her murder.
So it's unsolved.
It's an unsolved case.
Okay, that'd be interesting.
So we might want to look at that.
I do like to do some unsolved ones because I like to debate what you think happened is always fun to debate.
Oh, sure.
Okay, what is our next voicemail?
Next voicemail is from Jasmine, and she has a case suggestion. And this is a lady from down under.
Oh, nice.
Hi, Dick. Hi, Jill. My name's Jasmine. I'm from a town called Wollongong, which is south of Sydney in New South Wales, Australia. I just wanted to say I absolutely love your podcast. I have a lot of chronic pain issues, and your podcast is the only one I listen to help me get through the nights when everyone else is asleep and I'm still up. I really love that you focus on the victim, as, you know, that's something you don't see very often. Most, you know, crime podcasts and shows and things like that focus on, you know, the criminal and all the sensational details, but you really humanize the victims, which is a refreshing change. The only issue I have is you seem to think polygraph tests are valid, which so many studies have shown to be false. I mean, basically a psychopath, because of their unfeeling nature, can easily pass, and an innocent but nervous person will 9 times out of 10 fail. There's a reason they don't, you know, they're not admissible in court, guys. But, you know, the inventor of the polygraph himself is actually, well, had actually come out and said he's unhappy with how they're being used and that they are not accurate. But otherwise, the podcast is completely perfect. I do have a case suggestion for you from my town, from Wollongong. It's the murder of Wilhelmina Kruger in 1966 at the Piccadilly Arcade in Wollongong. This place actually has a motel on top of the shops, and I've actually stayed a few nights there. It's very seedy. It's known for drug activity, which I had no idea when I stayed there. But even without knowing about the murder, the whole place just feels off and really creepy. Wilhelmina's murder was absolutely brutal. She was 57 at the time and a cleaner at the arcade, and she was found at the bottom of the stairs in a parking area. But the police think she was actually attacked at the top of the escalators, then dragged down them, and then dragged down another set of stairs. Police aren't sure if she was alive when this happened, but the reason they think that she might have been was there was a blood trail as well as clothing and personal items scattered around the stairs. The murder sent a shockwave through the community, and to this day no one has been arrested or charged with the murder. There was going to be a documentary filmed by some local filmmakers, but their Facebook page has not been active in about a year. I don't know what you'll be able to find on this case, but it fascinates me and I'd love to hear your guys' take on it. As for a beer suggestion, I don't actually drink, but my partner swears by 150 Lashes Pale Ale by James Squire, and they're actually opening a brew house in Wollongong. So anyway, thanks guys, and just keep doing exactly what you're doing. Bye!
Thank you, Jasmine.
Yes, thank you. Now, I would say that we don't consider lie detector tests infallible.
No, we don't.
And I don't think we've presented them that way. I think they're helpful. Or potentially helpful, but I'm not going to convict somebody or free somebody based on a lie detector test.
Right. I don't know. I think that I change my mind often from podcast to podcast on how I feel about them. So I really have no defense of myself. I bet there are times when I've thought it's absolute and times when I don't believe it. So, but we do know there's a big gray area with them. We both would concede to that.
Absolutely. And as Jasmine said, that's why they're not admissible in court.
Right.
So, excellent stuff.
What was that we saw a show where they had something that they said was better than a lie detector when they recorded someone's voice?
Yeah, it was a kind of a voice analysis thing.
Yeah.
Where they could look at tone of or pitch of voice and stuff.
Yeah, it was supposed to be much more accurate.
Well, yeah.
And for some, but I can't think of what it was.
It wasn't accurate to the point of it being admissible either.
No, but it did seem like it was more accurate. Possibly. We don't know. Okay, so what about Jasmine's case suggestion? I see you have some notes on it here.
I do, and most of it is just a repeat of what Jasmine said.
Okay.
The one thing that I would only go further saying is that this Kruger murder might be related to the infamous Wanda Beach murder. And we've talked about that. I don't think we've done it, but we've discussed it.
Yeah, I think we talked about it in relation to the Beaumont children.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
These were two 15-year-old girls that were found mutilated and partially buried in the sand dunes at Wanda Beach.
Yes.
These cases are unsolved also. Then we have a guy who was arrested in 1966 for the murder of a 19-year-old woman named Carolyn Orphan. And during his time in jail, he presented a landscape painting to a detective. And the detective claims it contained images of positions of the bodies in the Wanda Beach murder, as well as details of the murder never released. And it also contained clues to the Piccadilly murder, the Kruger murder. Now, he apparently wrote a book, the detective did, discussing this theory, but he was killed in an accident before the book was finished, and it's never been published.
Well, that's sad.
So, there's some interesting stuff around that.
But this Piccadilly murder was very gruesome and strange.
It sure was. I mean, there's a rumor, and maybe more than a rumor, that she'd been disemboweled.
With a surgeon's precision, so that's pretty weird.
Sure is. We'll look into that.
Okay, great. And the beer, too, right? Have you had that beer? You didn't mention Allie's beer, either. Have you had either of those beers?
No, not yet.
So they'd be good to pick if we covered the cases.
Yeah, it might be easier to get a hold of some Rochester, Minnesota beers than Wollongong, Australia beers.
Sure.
But I like the name of that beer.
Absolutely. Well, we just love the way that Australians speak, let's be honest.
Okay, and one more case suggestion, voicemail from Jamie.
Okay.
Hey, Dick and Jill, this is Jamie. I just want to thank you so much for your awesome podcast. I look forward to it every week. Here's a suggestion for maybe one of your newer episodes, and that would be the case of Larissa Schuster. She is the one who worked with a colleague to kidnap her in process of divorce ex-husband, I believe, and dumped his body into a 55-gallon drum and drowned him with hydrochloric acid. I work in the science industry, and unfortunately, you know, just a small pipette, I've gotten a small acid burn on my thumb, and just the pain, I can't imagine how so callously one could do that to another living human being. Well, on a brighter note, Dick, I do look forward to your beer reviews every single week, too. I'm not a huge beer drinker, but the way you describe them does make a few sound a bit tempting. Well, thank you so much. Have a great day and continue with the great work. Thank you.
Thank you, Jamie. It sounds as if this woman put him in the acid while he was still alive.
Possibly. I haven't been able to figure that out for sure.
Well, that's what Jamie was saying, pretty much.
It sounds like. And it sounds like she knocked him out or something or had help and submerged his body in the hydrochloric acid. And that would take care of things.
Well, you know, in Breaking Bad, they would dissolve bodies in hydrochloric acid. But then Mythbusters.
I think they used hydrofluoric acid in Breaking Bad.
Oh, is that less caustic?
It's just a different compound.
Right, but you're saying hydrochloric acid would dissolve a body completely?
I'm not sure.
Okay. Well, the Breaking Bad acid would not.
No, but it ate through the floor.
Oh, and it would eat through your skin. It would definitely hurt like a bastard. I'm not saying it wouldn't hurt.
Yeah.
Yeah. But that's an unusual thing, especially for a woman to do.
Yeah. Well, and the case made national headlines, and she was dubbed the Acid Lady.
Oh, geez, what an evil person.
Yeah.
Okay.
You have to really hate your ex-husband's guts or estranged husband's guts.
I guess. I hope
that.
I never hate anyone that much. I can't imagine.
Me too.
Right. All right, let's do our emails.
Okay, we got a few emails. The first one's from Sandy. And you might notice that I just let the writer talk about the case. I didn't put any comments or anything. So.
Well, I think it's great when they give us information, sure.
Yep. So this is from Sandy.
Okay, and Sandy writes, "Hello, Jill and Dick. I have listened to your podcast for a very long time, but I've never felt compelled to reach out to you until now. I would like you to do a show on Mark Hutt, who was convicted of killing his wife. His wife was found dead in the basement of their home on a bed made of couch cushions hours after she died. But her death had started at least 11 days before, when her husband burned her over 40% of her body with boiling water. Her autopsy revealed that in addition to the burns, she had 2 black eyes, 8 or 9 broken ribs, and at least 30 pellets embedded into her body, some of which were inflicted after the burns, and numerous other injuries. Mark Hutt claimed that after he accidentally burned his wife, medical treatment was not sought out because his wife didn't want it. I came across this case on a YouTube channel, less than a 10-minute video, but there was surprisingly very little information on the case, i.e. the before story or the aftermath. So I'm hoping that with your great sleuthing skills, you might be able to provide your listeners with a more in-depth view of this tragic case. Keep up the great work and know that I am always present with you at the quiet end, listening intently to your every word, even the beer reviews. For a person that does not drink at all, I think I could hold a very lucid conversation on IPAs, stouts, and lagers with anyone, thanks to Dick's reviews. P.S. Where does the term tie grabber stem from?"
Sandy, thank you.
Thank you, Sandy.
It sounds like a really fascinating case, and I hope I can find enough information for us to do an episode.
Yeah, this talk about really hating someone and hurting someone,
yeah,
that's awful.
I didn't realize I put those back to back. It's kind of gross, isn't it?
It is, yeah, it's really terrible.
So, and you can answer the question about where tie grabber came from.
It's on our website. If you look at tiegrabber.com under About Us, you can read it. I'm sorry, I'm just not that fond of talking about personal things unless it's something that comes up in relation to a case. I'm kind of shy that way.
You are.
But it's a cute little story you can read.
Okay, moving on. Got a couple case suggestions from Shannon. Shannon says, I'm from Wichita, Kansas, and she likes our podcasts and blah, blah, blah. she says, as mentioned, I'm in Wichita, which is best known for the BTK killings. But fortunately or unfortunately, there are several Wichita cases that are just as interesting. So she's got a couple. The first one is the murder of Tanya Tandock. And she was the owner of Tanya's Soup Kitchen in Wichita. She was murdered in June of 2015 by Curtis Mitchell. Now, this was a friend of hers as she was letting him crash at her place. He beat and strangled her to death. Now, this case is most interesting because Tanya had such a big personality, funny and opinionated, and a belly dancer. That's a bit unusual, isn't it?
Yeah, that's cool.
Her restaurant is still in business and being run by her friends and partners. She's missed, and her absence is felt across the city.
I can imagine, yeah.
So then the second case happened in December of 2000. Online, it's called the Wichita Massacre. The Carr brothers went on a spree of random robberies, assaults, rapes, and murders, in which they killed 5 people and a dog.
Well, I have to draw the line at the dog.
Right?
Bastards.
So they did all sorts of horrible, gruesome things to these people after they robbed them, raped them, forcing them to do sexual acts on each other. They drove them to empty out their bank accounts at ATMs and then went onto a soccer field naked and shot them all execution style. They ran over the bodies in the truck they stole from one of them to make sure they were dead. Now, one woman survived the gruesome attack. Her hair barrette had deflected the bullet. So she walked naked more than a mile, eventually got some help. Meanwhile, the Carr brothers returned to the house to look for more valuables, and they beat this woman's dog to death with a golf club. And she testified against them in trial, and they were convicted of nearly all the 113 counts and sentenced to death.
113 counts. Holy shit.
Oh, they did a lot of mayhem.
These are awful, evil people. Gosh, you just wonder what would make anybody do that.
Yeah, so those sound good.
Yeah, maybe. It sounds pretty awful.
I'll look into them. Shannon says she's not much of a beer drinker, but she says her husband recommends a beer called Style Points by Central Standard Brewing.
I like the name.
Style Points.
Yeah.
So those cases, we'll look into those.
All right. Thank you, Shannon.
Thanks, Shannon. And then we have one final email from Doreen. She's talking about the most recent case we did, the two sisters that were abducted.
Bridge of Sorrow.
Bridge of Sorrow.
With Amy and Becky.
Right. So Doreen's for you.
Okay. So this was on YouTube, her comment. And she was just excited that there was an episode out because it was a holiday. And she says, I realized over this past week that I'm truly addicted to True Crime Brewery as well as both of you. I actually feel like I was suffering from separation anxiety. I can totally understand why this was a difficult story for you to do, Jill. I came so close when I was 15 in 1968. In the parking lot of a shopping center on my way home after purchasing a dress, I was approached by a man who claimed to be a police officer who said he believed I had shoplifted and took me to his car. I showed him my dress and receipt, and he advised me that he would have to take me to the station to be checked by a female officer. I totally lost it on him, and, well, I believe he thought I might be too much trouble, and he let me go. Well, good for you. As soon as I arrived home, my sister called our family friend, who was a police officer, who advised her it had not been a real police officer, and sent detectives out to interview me. At the police station, after hours of looking at mug shots unsuccessfully, I was driven home by police. On the way, I heard over the radio that after dropping me off, they were to proceed to a park in the central part of the city. And the next day, it was all over the news that a body of a young girl had been discovered at that park. She had been raped and murdered. I know absolutely that I escaped being murdered. Yes, Jill, this was a haunting and very sad story. I can imagine that she lived every day in fear, plagued by survivor's guilt and fear of them being released. Haunting, sad story. You both did an amazing job with it. I respect, appreciate, and value the dignity you both give to the victims and their families. Gratitude. Well, gratitude to you, Doreen. Thank you so much for writing. and for this letter especially.
I'm sure it wasn't easy.
No, and I have had close calls before, but I never found out that the person that picked me up actually did murder someone, the person that tried to pick me up. So this is really horrifying. I can imagine that you just know that you could have been the one who was raped and killed.
Yeah.
But we are very glad that you are alive and that you got away. See, it does pay to be a lot of trouble.
It worked.
Yep. I always make that my goal every day, to be trouble.
Well, you do a pretty good job.
Thank you.
All right. So I don't have anything more for feedback.
Okay.
We'll get some more for next week.
We get excellent feedback. I'd just like to say thank you to everybody again. And if you've written in and we haven't read your letter or played your voicemail, we probably will. Don't lose hope.
We probably will.
We usually get around to it.
A pretty good backlog, and I'm working my way through it. And I'm hoping that I'll catch up at some point.
You're doing a great job. I'm really glad that you took it over.
The downside is that if people keep writing to us and giving us voicemails, it keeps increasing instead of decreasing.
It does, but I certainly wouldn't complain because I just think it's great.
Not complaining.
You can always hire someone to help with it if it gets to that point.
Okay.
Okay.
Good deal.
All right. Well, thanks again, everybody, for listening. And we'll see you next time at the Quiet End.
At the Quiet End, where I'll be drinking a stout or some kind of beer.
All right. Bye-bye, everyone.
Bye, guys.